Well, if you're not sure what you're hearing right now, that's probably a good thing because it means you're not a spy. But this is the mysterious sound that started being picked up on shortwave radios on the 28th of February, about 12 hours after America and Israel started bombing Iran. It's the latest example of a very old and very reliable method of sending encoded messages to undercover agents known as numbers stations. It involves broadcasting what sound like random numbers over the radio, and it's the first time in more than a quarter of a century that a numbers station's been detected broadcasting in the Iranian language of Farsi. Dr. Tony Ingerson is an expert on counterintelligence and espionage, and he wrote about numbers stations and radio in the 21st century for the Journal of Policing, Intelligence and Counterterrorism. Dr. Ingerson, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you, Julian.
Could you explain for us, Tony, how a number station works?
Well, basically, it's just a big transmitter that broadcasts in all directions, although usually you have some intended direction, but that's not easily discernible. So it broadcasts in all directions over quite a long distance. And then pretty much anyone with a shortwave radio can tune in and listen to it. So the security of that communication is completely dependent on it being encrypted. And that is why you hear these seemingly random numbers. That's because that's an encrypted message.
And I've heard it described as a form of encryption which is mathematically impossible to crack. Is that right? And if so, why?
Yes. Theoretically, if you use what is known as a one-time pad to encrypt this message, and that is the usual solution, then it is theoretically unbreakable, at least as far as I know, that is still the case, even with all the computer developments that have occurred in AI and so. It's still theoretically unbreakable. And the reason for that is because the encryption key has to be as long as the message, and the encryption key also has to be as close to perfectly random as possible. So you simply add randomness to something, and that makes it basically impossible to remove the randomness because it is random. So you have to know what that randomness is by having a copy of the key, and then you can extract the proper message.
Yeah, so what exactly is a one-time pad, the way of decoding the broadcasts from a numbers station?
It is actually quite easy to teach someone to do it. I teach my students to do it. I can teach them in an hour or so. Is usually enough. So basically, the key that is used both for decryption and encryption tends to be just a string of letters. And these letters can be converted back to the alphabet. So you can get letters out of the numbers. And from there on, you just convert your message when it is in letters to numbers. So if you convert your message into numbers and you have the numbers on the key, then you can add or subtract to encrypt or decrypt. It is much easier to show on paper than it is to explain verbally, but that is the basic gist of it.
What are the security vulnerabilities of a numbers station?
Sometimes people make mistakes. So one mistake is if the people operating the transmitter, if they get a bit sloppy with how they encrypt the messages, the key is not sufficiently random. Or if they reuse the same key multiple times, then that creates a vulnerability that can be attacked cryptographically. The other possibility is that the recipient's key gets compromised. So, for example, the security service in the country where the recipient lives or operates, let's say they break into this person's apartment without that person noticing it, and they copy the key and then they leave, put it back. Now they can decrypt the messages at the same time as the recipient, and the recipient doesn't know it. So these are things that have happened and have been documented in some cases involving number stations.
Let's talk about this new number station that started when the bombing in Iran started. I think it's been called V32 by shortwave radio trackers. How much is known about the source and the purpose of V32?
The source has been roughly geolocated to Western Europe, last I checked. And it's actually not that hard technically to geolocate a transmitter of this nature, because you can use what's known as triangulation, because you can use a directional antenna. A directional antenna will show you which direction the transmission is coming from. So if you have people spread out over quite a far distance, so probably you have to be in different countries for this to work, depending on how far away you are, then you can compare the direction you get from your antenna, and then you can just draw it on a map and whether the lines will intersect with each other, and that will show you roughly where the transmitter is located. So you, even radio amateurs can quite reliably locate something like this. It's just a matter of time, usually, for them to cooperate across these distances. So Western Europe is probably a good guess, and it's probably going to get more accurate as time goes by. And for any nation state, basically, with any kind of basic signals intelligence capability, geolocating is much easier because they can coordinate their national assets to do it. So they can very quickly and easily locate a transmitter like this. So we have to assume that pretty much I would suspect every nation state in Western Europe knows exactly what this is and where it is. As for the purpose, we can only speculate. And that is pretty much the case for all numbers stations, because countries do not normally take responsibility for operating number stations. They do not openly admit that they're doing so, but it's only through geolocation that we can surmise basically who operates them. And based on who operates them, we can also draw some tentative conclusions as to what the purpose is and the intended target audience, as it were. So if this transmitter is operated in Western Europe, it has to be operated with some sort of acceptance from the local authorities, possibly even support, that is more depending on how the strength of the transmitter. So if it is operated out of Western Europe, it could be the Americans operating it, or it could be Americans operating it to support Israelis and the Israeli intelligence service. And since it operates in Farsi and it seems to be, the intended audience seems to be in Iran, a logical hypothesis at least would be that it is intended for either people operating undercover or people who have been recruited to spy, probably American or Israeli intelligence or European intelligence service.
And in that sense, is it likely that the numbers station is a response to the well-known actions of the Iranian government in shutting down internet access to the outside world as much as they could?
Well, it's difficult to know for sure, of course, but that would seem to make sense logically, that since they seem to have shut down internet access in Iran, it makes sense to activate this as kind of a fallback option. Because one of the main advantages of a number station is it doesn't need any kind of infrastructure except the transmitter and a very simple handheld receiver, basically. So when you have the transmitter up and running, the only thing the recipient needs is a small portable handheld radio that can run on batteries. You don't even need electrical power to receive these messages. And then you can do the encryption and decryption using pen and paper if you have to. It's that simple.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Tony Ingerson about the Farsi numbers station that popped up when the conflict in Iran began recently. And Tony, as if there wasn't enough excitement by the mere existence of this numbers station, then a few days after V-32 started, it was hit by a bubble jammer. What's a bubble jammer?
A jammer is just another transmitter that tries to drown out another signal. So in this case, the jammer tries to drown the signal coming from the number station. So that can be more or less successful. It can be more or less difficult depending on the nature of the transmission. Generally, it's hard to cover any large area with a jammer. It's hard to assess how successful it is, but the purpose of the jammer is presumably to prevent people in Iran from listening to this transmission. And that is one of the indicators that seems to speak in favor of this being a real clandestine transmitter operated by, let's say, American Israeli or Israeli. So the jammer is an interesting part of the puzzle, absolutely.
Tony, do number stations have any potential use other than by intelligence operatives?
I mean, I guess you could run a number station for fun, but the problem with that is that it's very much illegal to do so because, I mean, the airwaves are regulated in all countries. The only people who are allowed to transmit on these frequencies are amateur radio enthusiasts, and they are not allowed to broadcast broadly without any specific recipient. So even for an amateur radio enthusiast, it would be illegal to operate a number station. But that is why when we hear a number station and we can notice that it's up and running for some length of time, we can generally assume that whichever territory it's operating from knows about it and accepts it.
And is it the simplicity of reception and the quality of encryption that you've discussed previously, which explains why it is that in the 21st century, in 2026, intelligence agencies are still using a form of communication that's been around since World War One?
I mean, some things, they're good because they're good. I mean, they don't become less useful as time goes by, actually. And in some cases, they become more useful because any digital device that you use for communication, be it a phone or a laptop or a tablet or whatever, they will leave a ton of different traces. There will be forensic evidence on the device. There will be forensic evidence in terms of like communication logs, traces of where the communications have passed through and so on. One of the advantages of having a number station is that if you use a handheld receiver, it stores nothing. The only thing you have to keep in mind is that it's probably a good idea to change the frequency of that receiver so it's not tuned to the number station. But apart from that, it doesn't leave any trace. And there's no way to tell where that signal has gone, who received it. If you don't want to leave any kind of evidence for, say, hostile security service to find, then a number station is still a very good option.
So with that in mind, do you have a sense, Tony, of how many number stations are still in use today and who's using them that we know of?
There's actually only a handful of number stations operating today. There used to be more of them back during the Cold War, but there's still a few of them left that are transmitting routinely. For example, we have Russian ones, but also a Polish transmitter. There's one in Taiwan that's still active. And also, let's not forget the Cubans, their number station that has been involved in some high-level spy cases. The Ukrainians also used to operate a number station, but they shut it down in 2022, just when the full-scale invasion happened. They took it off the air.
And you mentioned some high-profile cases where the use of number stations, I think, has been revealed. What are some of the greatest hits of either intelligence successes or, I suppose, failures involving number stations?
Well, in recent times, the Russian spy ring arrested in 2010 in the United States were using a number station. So the FBI was able to actually observe them listening to the station. So they could see that someone's activity pattern is matching the broadcasting schedule of the number station, which, of course, is not the only evidence they had, but it is an interesting observation they could make. And back during the Cold War, there were also some interesting cases. So there was, for example, a Bulgarian spy working for the CIA who listened into a number station, but he got a bit sloppy. And so the Bulgarian security service, they got a hold of his encryption key, copied it, and then they were able to listen in. And things didn't end well for him. Probably no spoiler. But there's lots of cases involving number stations, actually. So it's been quite frequently used, especially during the Cold War. There are fewer cases today, but sometimes it pops up.
Tony, one of the other theories that I've read about is that in some cases, number stations are more a psychological tool than a way of communicating to undercover agents, that it's basically designed to make the other side think that you're communicating to undercover agents. What do you make of that theory?
I mean, hypothetically, sure, we could do it that way. It's nothing to rule out that possibility. I can say that I haven't seen any specific examples of that. So you can have a number station that broadcasts something that has no recipient, for example, just filler for the traffic schedule. But I do know of quite a few cases where I can match up the recipient with a number station. at least from the older cases from the Cold War, where things have become declassified. You can compare materials from behind the Iron Curtain with what we now know about transmitters that were operated in the West. And you can see that this matches up. So I do know of quite a few real cases. But of course, it would make sense also to use it as kind of a deception tool, albeit a slightly complicated deception tool. But sure.
It's really fascinating stuff, and it's been great getting the details from an expert, Tony. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Tony Ingerson, Senior Lecturer in Intelligence Analysis at Lund University in Sweden, who also wrote about number stations and radio in the 21st century for the Journal of Policing, Intelligence and Counterterrorism.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.